The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Clapp for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Clapp. This is the HOD Hour with Stan Clapp.
And this is the HOD Hour with Stan Clapp, as you might have heard. And we're welcome today with two guests on the line. Just to go back a little bit in why they're here, because on the 4th of October was Dyslexia Day and Dyslexia Awareness Day. And we have with us Kalabani Naidu, or if you like to call Kali Naidu, who's a clinical psychologist and expert in dyslexia. I've had to just give a little bit of background before we before I give her bio. So just to kind of set the pattern, I mean, dyslexia is not, it's well known, and yet it's not really something which you come across in everyday life unless you work in that type of community. And yet there are many people in the community who have it and are famous people, and they seem to thrive. People like Bill Gates is one of them, just for an example. And he fixed it up by putting on spell checker so he doesn't have to worry about the correct spelling. I have with us Dr. Natalie Solomon and Kali Kalabani, as a Kalabani or Kali Naidu. And by way of introduction to Kali, she's a clinical psychologist, social worker with multi-sectoral experience. We have to reach into that. In reaching children, and she's extensive educational delivery and training of educators, and I think that also is very much part of what the treatment of dyslexia is that you have to train the trainers. And we have Kali Naidu, who's a clinical psychologist. We're going to be talking about dyslexia. I'm not going to go into Altarara, but Kali is presently the course leader of Bella Vista Shares program in literacy and dyslexia, and works part-time as a clinician at the Vince Donald Gordon Medical Center. And her expertise is in, she's got experience in reaching children and their families, and mainly she trains people in helping others with dyslexia. I'm sorry to talk like a dyslexic. Kali, give us a little bit of background to yourself, and then let's talk about what dyslexia is, when you discover it. I think people need to understand what it's all about.
Just a little bit about myself. I worked in the early childhood sector for many, many years, and then in the area of HIV and AIDS with orphan and vulnerable children. And I also worked as a psychologist in the old education system. And I was always intrigued by how children in the early grades learn to read. And like most people, I was told children just learn to read. And then I started working at Bella Vista as a psychologist part-time. And I was exposed to the RAVO program. And thereafter to the British Dyslexia Association in the area of literacy and dyslexia, as well as the work within the US, particularly the work of Louisa Motz. And Louisa's work comes out of the work and builds on the work that was undertaken by the US National Reading Panel in the year 2000. And this research, Louisa has built what we call the science of reading. So she's taken what's come out of the research, and very high level research, in the sense that we've now not just cognitive psychology as looking at how children read, how they learn to spell, but also using technology like MRIs, PET, and diffusion tension imaging, to actually look at what the brain does when children learn to read. So simply, this reading builds on children's early speech abilities, And reading, unlike speaking and walking, is not something that just unfolds biologically. It's what we call, it's a cultural invention, and it is explicitly taught. And that's why that early years of teaching reading is so vital, because yes, parents and their exposure to books and literature builds a readiness for reading, but the real neuronal network that happens in the brain happens with that formal teaching of reading. So simply, dyslexia means dys, meaning a difficulty with reading. And generally we speak about it as a specific learning difficulty. Actually, in the UK, they talk about a learning difference. So we in South Africa still hold on to a medical definition, and I think that medical definition comes from the DSM-5 and all the prior versions of the DSM manual. But the UK and the US, the identification, or what we would say the assessment for dyslexia, is within the domain of teachers. It is not in the domain of a medical profession. Whereas in South Africa, it's still very limited to that. Only doctors and psychologists can actually identify dyslexia. And I think that's sad, because teachers are in the best position to identify children's reading difficulties. So, yeah, just having said that, this lecture is a specific difficulty with word recognition, and this word recognition difficulty might have or might play out as being difficulties with reading accurately or reading fluently, and then as a result of that, children struggle with comprehension, and their spelling might be impacted. And long term, we know vocabulary doesn't develop or grow at the same rate that typically developing readers' vocabulary develops. So
just to put it in simple terms, essentially it's making head and tail of what you see on the page. So if you're not reading it correctly, you're picking it up in different readings. So it's making it much more difficult to really absorb the information, comprehend, read, and so on, which must limit your learning ability.
Absolutely, Stan, because learning to read is a fundamental responsibility of the education system. And it affects all learning. Even if we're in a technology age and you can get support to bypass or help you to read and to spell, you still need to be able to read. So it affects all academic abilities.
So when a parent has a child grows up, goes to nursery school or some sort of creche or something, at what point does it become apparent, or is it something that only is discovered once child starts to read at school, or is something that you can pick up prior? And are there different levels of this? I mean, is it sometimes more severe, or sometimes less severe?
Yes, you've got quite a good understanding. It can be quite subtle and mild, and this is what we've also learned, that it can be mild, it can be moderate, it can be severe. And in the past, we used to say you're either dyslexic or you're not dyslexic. And now we know that it's on a continuum. You ideally, and yes, we used to say, again, this is a myth, that you can only pick it up once a child gets to formal schooling. But the early indicators or the signs are there, and the particular signs that we look out for are children who struggle with language in the preschool years. So things like learning to sing songs, follow nursery rhymes. So the child who's articulation and enunciation of words outlast what is developmentally appropriate. So, for example, children whose memory for longer words, like a word like crocodile, say cryptile for a very long time, or instead of saying spaghetti, might continue to use the word Getty. So there's a time when young children's vocabulary and they understand more than they can express, and even the numbers of syllables in a word, it's hard for them to hold in mind and to pronounce it. But when that remains, and the difficulty with the with learning kind of even right, what is the beginning sound in your name? And being able to identify the letters in your name. So we're not expecting young children to know how to spell and how to write their names, but to begin to play with the letters of the alphabet, to know and to attempt to write their names, and even if it's make-believe writing or random string of letters. But you're seeing the child, that's part of the developmental journey that they go through. But when they are struggling with sequencing, for example, knowing that you put your, when you, what goes underneath and what comes on top, or following instructions that might be a little bit longer. So, for example, I recently said to a young child, you can take a sweet that's in a bowl on top of the table. And he couldn't remember that sequence of instructions. But it's the sequencing, it's the memory, what we call working memory, holding things in your mind. And so those are some of the early indicators of potential risk. And the child who struggles to find words, they use a lot of things, their language is vague.
Are they dismissed as stupid? Or, I mean, is it something which kids get punished for because they're not doing it because there's ignorance surrounding the problem? Or is it something which, do people cotton on to the fact that there is a problem and do something about it, or is it something which is kind of a punishable offense in some hands?
I think I've also been guilty of it at some point in my life. When you teach and you teach and the child doesn't remember, you think, and then one day they can and another day they can't do it. So you think they're lazy. So often they're regarded as lazy because some days they can get it right and other days they can't get it right. And then often children, especially when in nursing school, it's less likely to be picked up. It's more likely to happen in grade one. And I think that's when it hits the children the hardest, because coming to big school is this major milestone in a child's life and the excitement. And then you can't do what other children are doing. And there's that excitement of learning to read. And when the child can't learn, a child is unable to learn to read, there is such a big impact on their self-esteem. So you start seeing these children either clowning or becoming distractible, or they withdraw, or they start thinking they're stupid and they can get teased. And often I think probably less so the more affluent schools, but generally in the mainstream government schools, teachers often associate the difficulty with learning to read and spell and write with intelligence. And we know that there's no correlation between...
Are teachers trained to pinpoint the problem, or is it something which they only learn over a period of time? I mean, when they're doing their training, are they educated in the sense that they, when they come to the classroom, they can recognize the person who's able to read or the person who's dyslexic? Are these things which teachers are equipped to do, or is it, hit and miss?
So we did a short bit of research in some state schools, and by and large, the parents picked it up sooner than teachers. So I would like to think that younger teachers are coming out better trained. I think there's two sides to the question. Is how are teachers trained to teach reading? And then secondly, how are they trained to pick up learning difficulties? So I think for older teachers, and even the best trained teachers that come onto our course say, you know, I've been a teacher and a foundation-based teacher for the last 25 years, and nobody ever talked about academic awareness or how you teach reading. We just taught reading. We just taught phonics. They're not trained to teach reading in a systematic way and based on the science of what works in teaching reading effectively.
Is this dyslexia, is it more prevalent in boys than girls? Or vice versa?
The debate, the pendulum has swung. At some point, we said it was just because girls are better behaved and they don't, they're not picked up. They don't have the behavioral issues that boys show in classes. And that's why girls weren't being picked up and it was thought that it was equal. But the research now is still showing that boys outnumber, it's like 3-1, that more boys are affected by dyslexia than girls are affected. It's not just an issue of identification or referral issues.
Somebody said that boys shouldn't go to school before they're 11. Girls should start much earlier because boys don't get it until much later. Is that right?
And boys shouldn't have children until much later too then.
That's another story.
But Kylie, can you tell us about what causes dyslexia?
So Natalie, the causality is quite, there's varied understanding of what causes dyslexia. But the key thing that we adhere to now is the fact that children struggle because language is so fast. When we speak, our words, our sounds combine. We don't break up a word like house as house. We speak, we say house. When you are learning to read, you have to have what we call an understanding of that small units of sound in a word. So house, you need to know it's her, our, it's got three sounds. But when we spell it, house, which is five letters. But so what we're saying is the key difficulty that's coming through from the research is that difficulty with what we call phoneme awareness. Being aware of the small units of sound in a word, but it's not just that sound, it's the ability to even play with the sound. So if I said house and I said replace the h with the d, it becomes house. Or if I gave you, instead of the h, replace it with a m, it becomes mouse. So it's being able to hold those sounds in your mind and to play with it, to manipulate it. And then added to that, now when you're beginning to learn phonics, you have to learn how the sound is represented by a letter or a series of letters.
And is there an underlying cause to that? I mean, is it something that they could, you know, weld two parts or solder two parts of the brain together and it will work? Or is it something which is more of a cognitive thing that's nothing to do with mechanics? It's a chemical thing, or is it a bit of both?
It's not a chemical thing. It's what we call a neuronal connectivity, the circuitry in the brain. So you're getting different parts of the brain to work like, you know, like your chip in your laptop. You're getting like a chip in your brain, but it's not a structural part of the brain. It's different areas of the brain having to work like a network, like a circuitry where the electrical energies quickly ignite different parts of the brain.
So can't they make it something that you could fix? I mean, could you replace that part with a new motherboard or?
Well, I mean, I think in part, Carly, I mean, I think what's so useful is how you spoke about it as being a learning difference. And certainly it's not, in terms of reading, it's not the most efficient brain, but yes. One wouldn't want to take away that chip because there are many valuable aspects to it in terms of seeing things quite differently. There are some advantages, to a dyslexic brain, although in formal schooling it can be very hard. And I remember you saying something about that some universities now are seeking out people with dyslexic capacities because there's benefit to it. Is that right?
So obviously, on that note, I mean, some people who have this are actually hyper-intelligent. So it kind of is the benefit may outweigh the problem.
Not for everyone. I think we mustn't get caught with that every dyslexic learner is gifted or can think out of the box, can be your Einstein or who did you mention, Stan?
Bill Gates.
Steve Jobs. I think that in any population, you're going to get some gifted people. And even with the dyslexic children, most people, the normal bell curve of how abilities are spread would apply. We will have a percentage of people that think creatively, think out of the box. Dyslexic learner is known to, you see, because they are using their frontal lobes and their higher order thinking much more. See, reading is much more a left brain function. So generally, the dyslexic learner tends to use their right brain and their frontal lobe. So that's why that's the asset that they have. But on the whole, most children are average. And I don't want to deny that we have highly gifted dyslexic people. Mary Ann Wolfe, who developed RAVO, says the world would be a poorer place if we didn't have these dyslexic individuals who think out of the box.
So what is the process of getting these people now into, can you train them to read, or is it something which you can't fix, you've just got to go and find a workaround?
So Stan, that is the heart of our work at Bella Vista. We train teachers and allied health professionals to be able to use what we call a very structured and explicit way of teaching reading and spelling. So, and we also use what we call a multi-sensory approach. What this approach does, it helps to build that circuitry in the brain. And the younger the child, the easier it is to build that circuitry. The older the child, it's much harder, it takes longer, but it is possible. And some elements, depending on how severe dyslexia is, some people, you wouldn't notice it at all when they're older. You might only pick it up, perhaps that they read more slower or they have to reread. But for other people on the more severe spectrum, they might still struggle with reading and writing and spelling, then you have to look at what are ways that they can compensate. How do they use technology? Like you said, Steve Jobs uses spell check. But there might be, there's some adults who say that the spell check can't even recognize their spelling.
Well, I was going to say, because if I take a look at the people that I know, I would reckon somewhere around 75% are dyslexic. If I look at how they spell things on there, when they send me text messages and SMSs and all that sort of thing, that's beyond the pale. They don't know how to spell in the first instance.
I think there's a shorthand for SMSs. Spelled it. I think it's a different writing system with their writing on SMS, so don't judge them too hard.
But if you don't have a basis of spelling, then you're bound to just pick up whatever it is. I mean, I've seen people send who I think are considered quite intelligent people, and they send me an SMS, and I've got to unpack it to try and understand what they're saying. Mm. Maybe I'm dyslexic, I don't know.
But therein lies the myth that spelling is a sign of intelligence, and that actually it's not. As long as the
what are you saying, Natalie? What are you saying?
That's exactly the myth that we're talking about. But it's interesting. I mean, I think that thankfully there are so many accommodations, and that actually, yeah. I mean, I'm wondering the importance of spelling has shifted in terms of like being a huge focus to. I mean, Carly, what is your sense? Has there been shifts in the educational system in terms of expectations and around old schemas?
So I think that the education system, even now at matric level, you're not marked down for spelling. And right through spelling, rewriting you shouldn't be marked down for spelling. And yet, free writing for young children is the one place where you pick up the dyslexia. When you look at the patterns of how they structure, that's where you will pick it up. But I think the Department of Education, both state and independent schools, allow for what we call accommodations. And children can get these accommodations from however young they need it. And I think often schools are not affording young children these accommodations until they get into high school, and then their problems are picked up. And by then, schools are reluctant to allow these accommodations. And it's then seen as, you know, you just want your child to get better marks, but this access to accommodations like extra time or having somebody help you read when you're in grade 4 and you're having to learn to take tests, or marking you down for spelling or helping you to fix if your spelling is that poor, or if your coordination is poor, or your speed of writing is poor, you know. So I think it is a place for to use accommodations more. What blocks the access to accommodations is we still link dyslexia to intelligence, and schools are still asking for intellectual assessments. And worldwide, even the DSM-5 talks about you recognize it by using school-based, what we call curriculum-based tests. And your achievement.
So you wouldn't pick it up on an IQ test. There would be specific school-based tests that you're talking about.
You know, if you did an IQ assessment, you have to be quite skilled for looking out for what kinds of difficulties exist. If you did an IQ test, you would have to do what we call achievement or school-based tests, achievement tests. So all your IQ is telling you is, What is this child's ability and how are they achieving? And if those two aren't correlated, you then are you advantaging only the children who are average intelligence or above intelligence. Whereas if there's that discrepancy between achievement and IQ, whereas we know you can have a reading difficulty regardless of what level of intelligence. You can be gifted, you can be below average, you can have lower intelligence, and you can still be dyslexic. It has nothing to do with IQ. You can pick it up. If you just look at a child's achievement and their oral language understanding. So
I've got a sign on my wall in my office which goes as follows. The letter 6, months, M-U-N-T-H-S. I couldn't C-U-D-N-T spell engineer, I-N-J-U-N-E-E-R. And now I are one.
Well, Stan, that's not uncommon. I have had discussions and we've had people come and talk at our conference where we've had a PhD in fine arts, and he says that his colleagues still look down upon him even after he had achieved his PhD. Spelling errors in his emails. So recently I had a doctor call in on the radio show and saying that she is a qualified doctor. Her father was a teacher and her younger brother is still at school and he's struggling to read. So the one thing we know is dyslexia tends to run in families. It has got a genetic component. But it has nothing to do with your intelligence, your ability to think, your ability to reason, and sometimes your ability to think in a different modality. So you might be good at thinking with pictures or visual and spatial. So often a dyslexic learner is good with thinking in pictures, thinking about maps, but they just have difficulty when things are in words and in sequences, and that's what they struggle with. So that person could have become an engineer, but struggled with an engineer, or is being spelled what we would say as the way it sounds. It's being spelled phonetically. And that is common what you see in the dyslexic learner. They spell the way it sounds.
Mm.
So what happens if you're now in South Africa and you need to be bilingual? So you're going to talk English. And then what happens if you need to learn Afrikaans? Is that now going to really confuse the system?
That's a bit of a controversial one. Historically, we used to say the dyslexic child should only learn the language that he or she is going to be taught in. What the research is showing, and I think in South Africa we've always had this understanding, and this has been kind of, I think, a colloquial, like historical intuitive knowledge. And I recently read an article. This has existed for a long while. They're saying that people that are bilingual or multilingual actually have got greater cognitive ability than children who are monolingual. So the same areas of the brain used regardless of the language. The same area of the brain is used for reading, for writing and spelling regardless of what language you're using. More importantly, is that language, is it an alphabetical system or is it what we would call a logographic system? So for example,
Hebrew.
Is Hebrew logographic?
I think so.
Yeah, I think more Chinese or...
Chinese, but the Chinese have now also developed an alphabet. So, for example, Afrikaans, let's take Afrikaans. Afrikaans is the way the word sounds, is the way it is spelled. So we say that writing system is transparent. It's an easier language to learn to read and write in. English is opaque. The way the word sounds is not the way it's spelled. So for example, church. Church, it sounds like ch. But you have to have a memory for that sound, for it's a digraph. So English,
or psychology.
Sorry? Or psychology.
Psychology.
Psy, S-Y, and the P, psy. So that's the root of English. English takes, it's a bastardized language, excuse the word. It takes from Latin, it takes from French, it takes from Spanish. So the spelling in English is quite difficult. But if a child is dyslexic, if they are learning Afrikaans, they might not struggle with learning to read in the beginning. You might see it coming through with their speed of reading. They might read slower.
So is it preferential to have, or if you had a choice, which language would you prefer to be dyslexic in?
No language, Ben.
Like me, I mean, I'm totally bilingual. I talk English and rubbish.
So do you read Hebrew, either of you?
Yes.
Yeah, to an extent. The problem with Hebrew is that you read from right to left, so already you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's quite hard because you're going right to left. But does it have letters or does it have symbols?
Yes.
Yes,
there are letters, but the vowels are symbols. So the vowels are like...
two dots or a little sign or three dots or that emphasis on that particular... And then some words they look similar, but they've got the vowel underneath it, which makes it sound different.
Okay. So it's tapping a lot into your visual recognition the same patterns.
And generally it's like got a root that's conjugated, like I think like French. So there's a three-letter root, and then it's different for me and you. It's quite common. It's supposedly quite a simple language system, but yeah.
So with children, when children have this, what is the effect on their psyche? I mean, do they feel when they go to school, or do kids laugh at them? How do you deal with that? I'm sure they must feel victimized in some way. Maybe the teacher picks them out.
Yeah.
There's got to be certain ways of dealing with people like this because, they're really impressionable at that age and they probably feel limited.
I'm going to answer both yours and Natalie's question in one. I think that there's no language that's simple. It's a bit of a misnomer. We tend to think that even African languages are simple. There are complexities in every language.
Sure.
We might have the sound and symbol association being more direct than in English. But even in African languages, if you think around how do you change a verb and how do you refer to female, I think every language has got its own complexities. So I don't think we must ever undermine the complexities of a language.
That is actually the beauty of language. So, some people do speak and write better than others, but we appreciate that. It's only when you're at a certain level and you're trying to make your way in the world that you come across these barriers or these limitations that one has and how do you overcome that. I'm presuming that the training or the teaching that you give to these children takes that into account.
So, and just the emotional component as well. I think we tend to emphasize a lot when we're intervening with children who are having literacy problems. And there's a spectrum. I mean, there's a child who's just struggling to learn to read because they've had poor teaching. And then there's a child who is dyslexic. So I think one needs to make that distinction. So the child who's just had poor exposure to reading, given good reading, will catch up. And I was one of them. I learned to read when I was in grade 5, only because that's the first time I was exposed to being read to and exposed to a library. And then once I was able to, and all the teacher did was to do, read aloud and dramatize. If you're my age, it was Treasure Island. Do you remember Treasure Island? You're too old, too young, Natalie.
I don't. What about you, Stan?
What were we talking about?
Treasure Island.
Anyway.
Yeah, okay. Carry on.
Stan, that would be, if I was standard 3, it's grade 5. So that's the child just hasn't been exposed. The dyslexic child, we tend to have this understanding that you need to be taught very explicitly, systematically, and multisensory so that the different areas of the brain will make those connections. But if a child is already, and I see this as early as mid grade 1, you can see it. In fact, you even see it in nursery school. When children are beginning to be aware that they don't like or they're not following the nursery rhymes or they're not following how a book is being read, they will find ways to not be involved.
Right.
When they get to grade 1, you start seeing the anxiety and the depression and they start feeling like they are not capable. And that's when self-esteem takes quite a knock.
Okay, so Collie, I'm going to say this. We've got half a minute to go. Unfortunately, it's been fascinating. I'm just getting into the subject and really would like to explore a little bit further. Just in a sentence, do you think we're improving in our knowledge and our understanding and our teaching of this, or is it, are we really running on a treadmill?
I think we are beginning to think, and some of the universities are taking on teaching reading in a more systematic way for undergraduate teachers. I think what we're needing to do is to, because a lot of it can be prevented. In fact, Louisa Moat says by the end of grade 1, you can 95% of children should be able to learn to read. Their only restriction is their reasoning abilities and their vocabulary. But there's a very small percentage of children, and that is about 20% of children, are truly dyslexic. So if we get the training of teachers right, and if teachers are trained to teach reading, understanding how reading unfolds, what are the skills, the sub-skills that children need to learn, we would prevent a lot of the reading difficulties, and for the mildly dyslexic, they will find compensatory mechanisms.
Okay, so Carly, we have to leave it there. The studio is jumping up and down. They want us to, although they cut us for 20 minutes, which was my fault, I guess. But I want to say thank you to you, Carly Nadu, Natalie Solomon. This is the Hebrew Order of David Hour. We've been talking about dyslexia. I hope we've turned that subject upside down and that we're going somewhere with it. I'd like to explore it some further and maybe come back another time. But thank you again. And I have to say good night now. I'm sorry that we didn't have more time, but thank you and good night, everyone.